Today is April 9th, 2018, and we're gearing up again and trying to get ourselves back in order. We're going to deal with the Gittes Rabbanim. It's the golden period between World War I to, I would say, the conclusion of World War II, more or less. It's hard to put years, but I would say till 50, 55 was the golden period of the Gittes Rabbanim. They reached their heights. The central relief bringing the great rabbis to America, that, you know, today we take for granted with travel, we go back and forth. You just mentioned to me Rabbi Bednash is coming back, what is it, today? And he's going out a week from now again. So that's you can do in the modern age. But to bring three great rabbanim to America, to have them there at the same time, and when you traveled, you remained, you didn't just jump back and forth the next day. This was a great achievement, and it has implications, as we'll see in a moment. The Ezras Torah, which was organized, and it really starts to function on a proper level in the mid-20s, when Rav Yosef Eliyahu Henkin takes over. But these were golden, golden moments. Now, with the Agudas HaRabbanim, and what's happening after World War I, this is something that today's generation finds hard to understand entirely. We're living at a time when there's a tremendous chasm, there's a tremendous pit, I would say, between Mizrahi and Aguda. And today, at one time in America, everyone was a Mizrahiite, and all the Mizrahiites went in Aliyah. Today, everyone is an Agudist in America. And you have a big chasm between them. You're not going to see heads of Mizrahi go to Agud and heads of Agud go to Mizrahi. One of the classic examples I can give you, which brings it very close to home, is Reb Heschel Schechter. At a certain point, and this goes back, I would say, maybe 30 years, Reb Moshe Scherer was alive, so he went to an Aguda convention. And some of the Agudistim knew who he was, and they tried to push him up, Zitzin Ebenon, to sit up front. And Rebbe Yitzvei was ready to walk out. If Reb Heschel Schechter would be sitting up front, Rebbe Yitzvei was ready to walk out. And needless to say, Reb Heschel never went to an Aguda convention again. But this is symbiotic of what goes on today. Following World War I, yes, Aguda did begin, but 99% of the Rabbanim in America related to Mizrahi, and there was some relationship to Aguda. It was not a contradiction. And you see from the minutes of the Gittes HaRabbanim that at every convention they appointed delegates to go to the Mizrahi convention, delegates to go to the little Aguda that was in America, which began in 1922 in America, but it was very small. It's very hard to say it really began then. It was very small. I told you, the only one Agudist in America who was a real Agudist was Reb Chaim Moshe's cousin, who was the Rav in Omaha, Nebraska, Rav Hirsch Grudzinski. They said he was a tremendous Talmud Chacham, by the way. I yet knew people who knew him. Wow. He was really an Agudist. But the rest, anything that's good for the Jewish people, they accepted graciously. You all know, and now we come to Rav Kook. When Rav Kook was in America, he became the focal figure. With all due respects, no one's here to give out who can learn better, the Levush Mordechai, the Avraham. That's not the question. The person that had the most prestige, it was a time of Zionism after World War I. Jews have nowhere to go. Jews suffer on the battlefield. Give us a home. And he was the chief rabbi of Palestine. So, at the Aguda convention that year, 24, the central speaker was Rav Kook. Now, in the volume on the early history of Aguda Yisrael, they summarize his speech. His speech is very fascinating in retrospect, because you see Rav Kook is dealing with the very problems that haunt us until today. And those of you that are familiar with the history of Rav Kook and Rav Zonnefeld, what was Rav Kook's big sin? Rav Kook's big sin that he reached out to the Chiloniyim. And bear in mind, we're going back 90 years, 100 years. This was a different generation. Today, take any name you want to give of a famous Jew. A famous Jew, Bibi Netanyahu, Barbara Streisand, any name of a famous Jew. No one in the world will rebuke us for reaching out to them. What do we want out of them? Bibi Netanyahu, his own father, they say, didn't fast on Yom Kippur. All right, his father had it in for his father, who was a Rav. But his own father didn't fast on Yom Kippur. Bibi's father lived in Katamon. My children know exactly where he lived. No one ever saw him in a shul. And Katamon is filled with shuls. So you can't be angry at Bibi. Rebbeinu Shalom, what they saw, Barbara Streisand, yes, she had parents who she never gave, she resented her mother. Her mother felt she was wasting her time singing. She'll never amount to anything. A girl has to be down to earth, practical. She should be a secretary, etc. What did they see for, of Yiddishkeit? But when you're dealing with the generation of the 1920s on to 100 years ago, these people were all raised in frum homes. You talk about Ben-Gurion, what kind of home did he come from? And you can go one and one, you talk about Chaim Weizmann, what kind of home did he come from? So Rabbi Yosef Chaim Sonnenfeld and his ilk, how do you talk to these people? How are you decent to these people? These people you have to rebuke, you have to tell off. Look at the Rambam and Hilchat Tshuva. Look at the Rambam and Hilchat Deyat. Your whole attitude towards them has to be your Machalavei Shabbos, Olchein Neveilten Treifat. And Rav Kook, on the other hand, was never negative, was always positive, and he praised them for what they're doing, building the land. You do have a mitzvah, Yishuv Haaretz, etc. And here I'll repeat something from the Rav that Rebbe repeated a number of times. I heard it from the Rav, and I want to say it's the Rav's 25th Yahrzeit. So let me say this: L'zeichem Mori Rebbe, whose Yahrzeit was just last week. So the Rav, I told you more than once, we always suffered that the Rav came in on Tuesday, went home Wednesday afternoon. We only saw him in the classroom, and he gave shiur, and that was it. And all you had was brisket Torah from the Rav. You didn't have anything else on that level when you were a student. So we bothered him, we badgered him, and finally he agreed to meet with us. If I'm not mistaken, it was a Wednesday night. For whatever the reasons were, that week he stayed in New York, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, went back on Thursday. At times he did that, it depended. He had a wedding, there was a Mizrahi affair, there was something at Moriah. He was only a human being. But this was a time when he was already after his operation and he wasn't as young as he was a year earlier, we'll put it that way. It was 1960. And we got the Rav to stay Wednesday night. He met with us in Klein Hall. I walked past Klein Hall a few times in Washington Heights. For me, you know, I walk past, I see the past before me. It's tangible. So in Klein Hall, there was a fire, I don't know what there was today, there was a fireplace, like a living room, and there was a picture of Yitzchok Yochanan Spector on the wall. I can see it in front of my eyes. And in that hall, we spoke with the Rav, we threw questions at him, and it was a night in history, a night of the Rav talking Hashkafa with his students. That one word of brisk, but pure Hashkafa. So one of the topics we got involved with was Rav Kook. And the Rav spoke about Rav Kook, and the Rav told us that he visited there in 35. Of course, he met Rav Kook. Rav Kook was on his deathbed already. So you can't really say it was a real meeting with Rav Kook. But the Rav did give shiur in Merkaz HaRav, and Rav Tzvi Yehuda Kook attended, Rav Chalap attended. In other words, all of the top Rashi Yeshiva, all of Rav Kook's intimate followers, disciples, teachers, partners, children, Talmidim, they all attended. And the Rav toured Israel, and he got to know some of the stories about Rav Kook. And he told the story about Rav Kook. It probably goes back to the famous, I think it was 1914, he and Rav Chaim Yosef Sonnenfeld Aryeh, they started out together. Rav Chaim Yosef Sonnenfeld turned back. He didn't complete the journey. obviously he couldn't handle it. You can understand why. But Rav Kook went to all the religious kibbutzim and to the Ganya and other places, and here he comes, and what can he get? He was there for Shabbos, and Rav Kook spent the whole Shabbos with them, and he spoke. And then at the end of Shabbos, didn't give one word of Musa, and Rav Kook makes Havdalah, and these people, all of them grew up in homes where they knew what Havdalah was, and Rav Kook says, "Bapam haba sheni pagesh, ani mekaveh shenochal yachad." We'll be able to eat together. And Mori Rebbe said that they were machshir their dining room after Rav Kook spoke. That if Rav Kook should come again, if a religious personality should come again, they should be able to eat together. And the Rav told this story. He spoke about Rav Kook as a religious personality, the influence he had. Now, here speaking to the Aguda Convention, Rav Kook relates to this very problem. The source is right here. And he says that by reaching out to the Chiloniyim, he says, yes, it's true, there's Chilul Shabbos, all the problems that you hear about. But he says, there's no question that these people are doing good. They're building the land. And I have full confidence they will return B'Lev Shalem to Torah Hashem Tamima. He adds on a postscript and he says, for Haraya, they just built a beautiful synagogue in the new Jewish city of Tel Aviv. And the synagogue, Mi banad se al yedei chiloniyim, ובכל זאת היא נבנה על פי המסורים כל הפרטים, ואין בו אפילו זכר לרפמים. אם לא זכינו עדיין להגיע לאחרית הימים, אבל בלי שם ספק הננו קרובים לזה. All right, you can view this as being very naive or being very prophetic, but what's mentioned here are problems we struggle with until today. And Ein Hachinami, the shul in Tel Aviv, was built, and all of us have davened there over the years. I remember when I was in the army, I always used to catch a mincha there. If I had a lecture late in the afternoon, I was going to the Russian compound to deal with Russian problems. Many times I caught mincha there. And could be during the winter I caught Marav there. And yes, the shul, and now they're resuscitating the shul. The neighbors said, you all know the problems of Tel Aviv. But Ein Hachinami, the shul is 100%. But you see, that was a generation that knew what a shul was. A shul has to be a shul. Ben-Gurion would never set foot in a Reformed temple. You understand? Not that he was from, but if you're going to shul, it has to be a shul. Today, can we still say that this is true? Ehud Barak's daughter got married. A Reform rabbi in Tel Aviv performed the wedding. Ehud Barak. I mean, look what we're talking about. Ehud Barak is an anacle of Bork. His great-grandfather was one of the big leaders of the Nevadic movement, was a Talmud Mufak of Rabbi Yisrael. And his daughter, Israel, do they have these same values? Look at the cultel. Look what went on. Look at these parties we have to build for the Reform. And it's amazing. No one quoted Rakefet. Common sense. Who said a Reformed Jew can't daven where there's separate seating? He can be, I'd say, davening. There's no halach in Reform. You must not make seating. So they're building this whole area at the cultel. Now, did you go to view that area during Cholamayim? The kotel was filled, tens of thousands of people. Birchat Kohanim, over 100,000 people, the biggest crowd they ever had. If you went to view the area built for the Reform, there was no one there whatsoever. But the concept today, no, you have to allow. You all heard the politicians, the way they speak. And I can give you even a more shocking example. Tel Aviv U was of all the universities, it was the most anti-religious of all the universities. Not Hebrew U, not the Technion, not Be'er Sheva, but Tel Aviv U. You had to look with candles to find the kosher cafeteria there. Now it's much better. But years ago, then they didn't have a shul. So the pressure was on them to build a shul. And they built a shul, got a donor, but they put down a condition, has to be a Torah shul, or what they call Orthodox, and a Reform shul. No, if you go to Hebrew U, you're going to Tel Aviv U, you're going to see back-to-back a shul and another building, and you're going to say, what is this? And they're going to be told this is a Reformed temple. Nu, halacha l'maisa, have you been to Tel Aviv U? When was the last time the Reformed temple had a minyan? So what goes on there, it's a Beis Medrash. Students, they fall out of the shul and they learn, they sit and learn, open gemaras there, etc. But in theory, it is there to service a Reformed temple. So you see what Rav Kook is talking about here. Just think, this is 1924, and these issues have not resolved themselves until today. We struggle with it. We live with it. What's the right approach? Modern Hebrew, they made up a new word, hadatah. It's a new word. That word didn't exist until this last year. What does hadatah mean? If someone is standing on the street corner, it happened in Netanya, they stopped the Chabadnik from putting tefillin on people. It's religious coercion. Hadatah, word dot. That's the new word in Hebrew. All right, it caused a tremendous outcry, and he's back on the streets there. But the very fact that you can think that way, 100 years ago, Rav Kook is right. Even the biggest apikoros didn't think that way. But fascinating how he turns to the Agudas Rabbanim, how he raises these issues. It's life before our eyes. And ein hachinami, this was Rav Kook. And in America, he was absolutely adored. Maybe Rav Hirsch Grzinski was a negative voice about his attitude. But in America, he carried the day, and we all know as American rabbis, those among the rabbinate, how many Jews we had to turn to. Could you rebuke a Jew? Could you say something? Could you tell him off? You'd push him away. You'd scare him away. One of the basic lessons I learned in my first rabbinate, you get a lot further with honey than with vinegar. And here is Rav Kook speaking 90 years ago. Okay, but now I want to come to the heart of today's Shia, and a story that is totally forgotten. I don't know how much more research can be done, meaning I simply don't know. I have a feeling that the papers do not survive. But this is a true story, and it absolutely happened with the pros and the cons. World War I comes to an end. Tell me, in two World War I, where were all the Svarim printed? In Europe? Nothing. Was there ever a Shas printed in America before World War I? Absolutely not. All the Svarim, all the Tefillin, everything that you needed for rituals was brought over from Europe. Stores sold it on the East Side. No different than today. Today, by the way, almost all the publishing of Sfarim is done in Israel. Oswald, of course, is a major publisher, but the actual printing, as you all know, is done in China. It's a different world today. So after World War I, you really lack for Sfarim. And Rabbanim in America need Sfarim. You have now Yeshiva Shabitzko Hanan. It's a yeshiva. It has students in it. By 1920, you're talking a few hundred students. You have beginnings in Brooklyn. Torah Vadas is beginning. RJJ is functioning. It's too early yet for Chaim Berlin. But you have, for the first time, you have Chassidic Rebbeim in America. No one is very successful yet. The first Chassidic Rebbe who catches on in America is the Beyana Rebbe. And he comes in the mid-20s. That's on the east side of New York. He's the first Chassidic Rebbe where really he has some followers. It doesn't become a mass movement. In other words, what I'm trying to say is, yes, there were two or three Rebbeim in America before World War I. If you read, a volume came out, there was an attempt to build a kehillah in New York. Are you aware of this? There was a doctorate done, Moshe Rishon did a beautiful doctorate at Columbia University on the attempt to build a kehillah. And this was a serious attempt. It did not succeed because we Jews don't lend ourselves. That's why I always say the fact that we have an army is the greatest miracle of the state of Israel, that Jews can take orders. But we Jews don't lend our Rabbi Yaakov Yosef. We did this in class. Is declared chief rabbi within 2 weeks. Rabbi Witowitz has to sign up, chief rabbi of the United States and Canada. And Jews don't take orders. And this is the army is an amazing miracle. So they attempted to build the Kehila. It functioned for a good 10 years. And it had a structure and all that went with it. And they did a yearbook. I own a copy of it. It's the only book I ever bought on, it was auctioned off. I think I paid $10 for it. It's 100 years old and it's perfect. The binding is good and the pages. And it describes all the shuls, everything you have in New York. I've used some of it in my own research. In Washington, when I described the shuls on Washington Avenue, that's the book where I got the facts from. How do I know where Zera Yaakov, when it was organized? But here you have everything black and white. So there were 2-3 Hasidic Rebbeim, but they were tolerated. In other words, it's not that they had followers or people. They had the elderly Yidden who still remembered the old country and were happy to support them. The Biyana Rebbe was the first one that he built up a small but a very devoted, dedicated following. And that was in the mid-20s. So you have people who need Sfarim. So here the Agudas HaRabbanim came up with an idea. This is right after World War I, 1918. They met at the summer home of Ramaz, Reb Moshe Zvulun Margolis, for whom the school is named Ramaz, at Belmar, New Jersey. At his summer home, Rabbi Revel came, Reb Yitzchak Halevi Siegel, do you recognize that name? He was the Rav of Jersey City, of that area. He lived to be 102. He was one of the big makshirim in the poultry, in the slaughterhouses, in the New Jersey area with Elizabeth, that area there were a number of slaughterhouses, Secaucus slaughterhouses, and a lot of kosher meat, a lot, and millions of tons of kosher meat over the years came, and he was one of the Rabbanim HaMachshirim. Could be when you were growing up, you remember Siegel and Weller. Those were Louis Weller, Aryeh Leib Weller. He was Rav of the Brisker Shul in Newark, and Rav Yitzchak Halevi Siegel of Jersey City with the big Machshirim. And they all came together, and I have to tell you, Rav Lazer Silver, of course, by now is playing a role, and they came up with the idea, we have to print a Shas. And this was revolutionary. In the United States of America, you're going to print the Shas? So they appoint the committee, and some of these people had a lot of, I would use the word, business sense. The fact that they were in Kashrut, the fact that they were people who were outside the Dalet Amot of Halacha, these people already had street sense. And they look around, and they finally settle on, you know where the Shas was published? In Montreal, Canada, Eagle Publishing Company. There was a Balabas there who, again, there were many Jewish dailies. And this Balabas, I believe his name was Lovsky, he was from, and he had a printing press, and he put out a Jewish daily in Canada. And that's where the Shas was published. Now, where do you get the money to start up? Everyone is aware, nothing in life is cheaper than it used to be. When I went to a school in the early 50s, I remember you could pick up a New York Times for 2 cents. You rode on the subway, 5 cents. Today, you pick up a New York Times, what is it, the daily paper, $1.50? No, $2? I mean, it's beyond words. Everything in life is more expensive. You picked up an ice cream cone for 5 cents. Today, an ice cream cone, a face, $1, $1.29, right? There's only one thing in life which is infinitely cheaper, and that is publishing. The difference between what was and is, it's like computerization has changed the world. My first book, Rebel, the first edition, The type was set by hand. Just think what I'm saying. Type was set by hand. Today, you give the printer a computer program that effaces the size of a fingernail, and out of that computer program, people send me books, they want her stomach, they send Sherry an email, she prints out a 500-page volume for me within minutes. It's a different world. It's much cheaper today. Today, we have endless books. Walk into the Beis Medrash. I see this new book, that new book. Anyone can publish a book. All you need is a few cents. Put it together, and you can get a vanity publisher. A more chashuv publisher, you need a little bit more money. But we're talking pennies compared to the dollars of old. Now, in 1918, they want to publish a shas. They have to come up with money. And here's the minute Rabbanim get involved in money, lo tov haderech. I don't have to elaborate, we'll go into kashrut shortly, but the minute Rabbanim get involved with money, at halacha lemaisa, life taught me, some of you know, I do not touch money. People, I do not touch money on principle. What I have seen in life, God have mercy. Okay, the key family here is the Travis family. Yeshiva becomes one of the big supporters. They need the Sfarim to have a personal interest. Well, in order to get involved, you have to invest money. Where is Yeshiva Reb Chochanan going to get extra money to invest in publishing Shas? 1918, the Travis family is still very important, very wealthy. They are not suffering the losses of the 1920s when Rockefeller cuts into them and is able to use monopolistic tactics to gain the entire market. At this point, the Travis family of Marietta, Ohio, Tulsa, Oklahoma, this is the family Revel married into. I've said it many times, and we all understand it. We owe the biggest thanks for Yeshiva University being around today to Mrs. Sarah Revel. She was a Travis. Rabbi Zivitz of Pittsburgh made the shidduch. He marries Sarah Travis, and that shidduch is what ultimately gives us today Yeshiva University. So the Travis family makes investments. So now you have the yeshivas, Rabbi Chochanan, involved in a business venture, Rabbanim involved in a business venture, republishing Shas. But here's the sad part. We Jews, we're always under the carpet. You read the websites, the Orthodox websites, the Frum websites. Oh my gosh, what goes on under the carpets. So right away, people started yelling, shouting, Chilul Hashem, Yeshivas Reb Yitzchak Chochanan is involved in money and publishing a shas. Who ever heard of a yeshiva going into business? This is not their area. They shouldn't be involved. People are going to pocket money. The profits won't go to tzedakah. And you had a real problem. It's amazing what survives. What I'm holding in front of me, here is a telegram. Do you remember, Yosef, you know what a telegram was? You don't even know. You heard of it. Baruch Hashem. It's before, long before emails. Telegram sent at the halacha in the 1880s, 1890s, became very important to be matir and a guna. You follow me? How much can you be samach on a telegram or to send the get, to give a hasha'ah? So you have already shivered on telegrams. But here is a telegram. By the way, that's Rabbi Rebel's handwriting on it. If you notice, Rabbi Rebel wrote Shas. It went into the file that dealt with the Shas project. And the telegram says, Rabbi Dr. B. Revel, Oklahoma Petroleum and Gas Company, Tulsa, Oklahoma, December 8th, 1918. Here's the text. Together with Rabbis Rosenberg, Konvich, will leave St. Louis at 8:10 for Tulsa. Regards to all of yours, Rabbi L. Silva. and you see what this was about, if you go into Bernard Revel, I found these documents. I found I was able to use. I don't know what more exists, but if you go into Bernard Revel, here's the whole story in a nutshell. They finally reached an agreement, the yeshiva, the Igurus HaRabbanim, the entire Shas, the Eagle Publishing Company of Montreal, Canada, and the yeshiva had to put out a certain amount of money, and the fundraisers for yeshiva were ecstatic with it. Why? And this gives you an idea how the yeshiva survived then. How did yeshiva raise funds? They raised funds with Meshulachim. Do you remember Meshulachim? It's an era gone by, but I'll give you an example. You've heard Moshe Talansky. Does the name mean anything to you? He saved the world. If not for Moshe Talansky, the Arabs would be dancing on this property already. Right? He saved the world. Olmert winds up in jail. He couldn't give away Yerushalayim. Moshe Talansky's father was a Meshulach for the Mir Yeshiva. I still remember his father. And the Meshulachim, I don't know if we mentioned it here, mentioned it elsewhere. There's a lot written. What percentage could they keep? And I told you, Rav Yosef Paskind, up to 49%. Up to 49%. He said, if not for Meshulach, the Yeshiva would have nothing. So he says it's for the Yeshiva, 51%. But he can take 49%. I don't know if all Meshulachim took that much money. It's a tremendous amount. But they certainly took 20%, 25%. So here a Meshulach goes to Trenton and he raises $633 that Shabbat. And Ramaz told Rabbi Revel that this money, never before did they raise so much money from Trenton. And why? Why did they succeed? Because the Balabatan loved the concept that the yeshiva is involved in publishing the Shas. So you see, there were positive factors, but there was plenty of Lashon Hara, plenty of Rechilut, and it was felt for the good of the yeshiva, they should withdraw as formal sponsors and let the Agudat HaRabbanim be the ones that published the Shas. And they came to see Rabbi Revel, and an agreement was reached that yeshiva would get 30 sets of the published Shas in return for the $3,000 that the Travis family invested on behalf of the yeshiva in this project. By 1920, the entire Shas was published. It was a great achievement. The Central Distribution Committee, the JDC, the Joint Distribution Committee, bought many of the Shasim. These were Shasim that were distributed in Europe to the Rabbanim, to the survivors. All over the world, the Rabbanim, the survivors, praised America, Canada, that, believe it or not, a Shas could be published in the New World. Financially, the Agudas Rabbanim claims they lost a fortune of money, but the achievement was great. And this too was the Agudas Rabbanim. Today, you don't think of these terms because publishing is so cheap. Anyone can publish a Shas. It's no big deal. Yeah, Morty, then we'll get you through.
How was it done? Was it typeset?
It was a copy of the Vilna Shas. It was an absolute copy of the Vilna Shas. No one has changed the format. All the Shasim that are published are all the Vilna Shas. But this was exactly, you can take this. The Eagle Shas is widely available. It's not I remember growing up and seeing, if not tens of copies, at least tens of copies. You can compare it to the original Vilna Shas. It's exactly the same with some sort of photo offset. By then, they had that ability to do a photo offset. Today, you can do it already with scanning. It's a much more accurate way of doing. I myself, this morning, I'll tell you what I'm playing with. I'm putting together for the new book. It's taking a while. It's not going to be out so quickly, but within the year it'll be out. So I'm putting together some documents. and leaving out, you know, the Torah is the Torah, the history is the history, but I want to publish some documents that I consider important. So one of the documents, the Yad Shkol world totally neglects Rabbi Revel and what yeshiva, you know, it all began with Mr. Shraga Feigl Mendelovich. So one of the documents I have is the advertisement, the ad, the Moda'at Evel that Mr. Mendelovich published when Rabbi Revel died. So this document speaks for itself. In addition, I got hold of a young man who's in his mid-90s today, who was sent, he describes how Mr. Mendelovich sent the whole delegation from Teira Vadas with two Rebbeim to be present at the funeral and say Tehillim around Rabbi Rebel's bier. And I had him go to a lawyer, a Talmud of mine, and a notarized statement describing what happened in Teira Vadas when Rabbi Revel died. Now, this morning, I'm playing with the original. The typing is not the best. It's from more than 20 years ago, etc. So I played with the Xerox machine. The copy I made is twice as good as the original. If you can adjust the light, the darkness, the density, it's amazing what you can do today. So I don't say the Yigal Shas is on the level of what you can do today, but it's a photocopy. There's another Shas that comes out. Don't confuse it. You know what other Shas I'm talking about? 47, Munich, World War II? That the when they went into the DP camps, so one of the things they requested, Sfarim, where do you get Sfarim? And I believe it was General Eisenhower. That's why he was so popular with the Jews. The Rav said Stevenson can never defeat Eisenhower because he's popular with the Americans, a war hero, a cowboy. And he's popular with the survivors, what he did. And he gave the word. They published the Shas at the expense of the Germans, all the paper, everything. And that Shas, too, was quite an achievement. But also, it's a photo offset. There's no real new typesetting or cleaning up mistakes. That only happens much later when we become more sophisticated. Yes, Yitzchak.
You told us about once the genius of the world that he went to the,
right.
Went to get money from the JDC.
Right.
And he started off.
Right, with the Shas.
With the story about first he started off
the
with
cocoa.
The story of the chocolate. Right. Then he went into the story. He said he never in his life, as a child growing up, saw that
right.
The Shas could be new. It
right.
Was always a tattered volume.
Right, right.
And all of a sudden,
right.
There was great new Shas.
By Rav Velvel was the Briska. Yeah, the Rav told that story, a magnificent story. But you see, there's the other story of the Rav I thought you were referring to, that I have. I believe I have it in the Rav. If not, I did it in class within context. But the Rav told the story. When they did the Shas after World War II, the order, one Masechet was after Sanhedrin, I forget, was it Makot, whatever. It was placed in a different order than the regular Shas. And there was this conservative rabbi, Rabbi Shubo. And the Rav was very close to him. He was very close to the Rav. There was a deep relationship between them. You remember the name, Rabbi Shubo? Yeah, and you know who he was. He was the Rav of what was the name of the general? Patton's army? Patton was the name of the general? The wild general. He was like Sharon. He didn't take orders. He acted on his own, but he was a war hero. So it seems after the war, Patton loved this Shubo so much, he gave him permission to use the Jeep for one full year after he was out of the army. And old-timers from Boston told me that they always knew when Shubo was coming because he was coming in a World War II Jeep. So one time Shubo calls the Rav and he says, Rebbe, I found that I need a source. I think it's Masechet Makot. I have to check what I wrote, but I think it's I had the Rav word by word. And he says, I can't find it. I can't find it anywhere. And the Rav tells him, the Rav thinks, and he tells him, you know what? Look at your Gemara. See if it isn't after Baba Batra instead of Sanhedrin. And the guy goes, and he looks, and he says, take us back to the phone, Rabbi Soloveitchik, you're a genius. No wonder everyone calls you a gone. You're a genius. I found it. And the Rav breaks into laughter. The Rav says, well, I didn't want to tell him, but I knew that the shots they published after World War II, they put Masechet Makot instead of in back of Sanhedrin, they put it in Baba Batra. So the Rav said, I figured when he told me he can't find the Makot, it has to be that shots. And the Seder is wrong. So all right, that's I believe it has to be checked out. If you check out that World War II Shas, I remember it shows the rising sun on it. Do you remember? Did anyone see it? It shows that we're going to be reborn after World War II. I'm sure your father was familiar with it.
We have a Shas that was printed in China,
Shanghai. I have in my office. I have a volume. I have one volume. Yeah. One volume. A Talmud bought for me a gift to Shanghai. Now, I also want to mention at this point, I want to mention one name and give you a source. Labriot, because he also was very active. You mentioned Rabbi Rebel, you mentioned Rabbi Henk, and you mentioned Rabbi Blazer Silva. And here, it's someone that basically has been forgotten, but he played a very crucial role. And I'll explain to you what I'm talking about. His name was Rabbi Israel Rosenberg. And here, I'll introduce you to another person. If you recall, earlier this year, people were visiting Israel, the Shurins. Rabbi David and Esther Shurin. Now, Rabbi David's father was Rabbi Aaron ben Zion Shurin. Has anyone recognized the name? Rabbi Aaron ben Zion Shurin was a Litvish Talmud Chacham who got to America, what was it, the late 30s perhaps? He studied in Yeshivas B'Shulchan, and he still studied with Rabbi Revel, studied with Rabbi Moshe Soloveitchik. And he became very close to the YU scene, to the Soloveitchik scene. As a matter of fact, his sister married Rabbi Aaron Soloveitchik. Elka Soloveitchik was a Shurin. Ella Soloveitchik was a Shurin. I trust all my figures, my biographical details are correct. You can correct me if I'm wrong. And it was a well-known family, the Shurins, a well-known family. So Rabbi Shurin made a panasa. He became a Yiddish writer, and he was hired by the Forwards. The Forwards, as it is until today, anti-religious, anti-Torah, but they needed someone to write about the scene who understood the scene. And he became a writer for the Forwards. He published many Sfarim. He, based upon his writings in the Forwards, mainly the biographical rabbis, he published a number of volumes in Hebrew. He translated from the Yiddish to the Hebrew biographies of Rabbanim, people he wrote about. He taught at Stern College. He was Zeicher L'Aricha German Tov. He died a few years ago in his late 90s. This was Rabbi Aaron ben Zion Shurin. Now I'm quoting to you from his first volume, Keshet Giborim, published by Mossad Rav Kook, and he has a biographical study of Rabbi Yisrael Rosenberg. The study begins on page 259. Rabbi Yisrael Rosenberg's years, 1875-1956. Now, Rabbi Rosenberg's greatness was a Talmud Chacham, a Litvish Talmud Chacham, but a person with a lot of common sense, the ability to make peace between the Rabbanim. And he plays a key role when you talk about the interbellum period, you talk about the Igudus HaRabbanim. He was the individual. You take, let's say, Reb Blazer Silva was a genius, was volatile. He could shoot from the hip. He could yell. He could shout. This was Reb Blazer Silva. You dealt with other individuals. They were tzaddikim yisodei olam. You'll take Reb Yosef Eliyahu Henkin with little concepts of reality, of what America was about the Western civilization. Here was a man who refused any increase in salary, even though the cost of living had gone up. They voted him a trip to Israel on his 50th anniversary with Ezra's Torah, refused to take it. The Ezra's Torah can't afford it. And this man was Tzadik Yesod Olam. Who did you have who was a down-to-earth individual and was able to move the Agudas HaRabbanim further? And this was Rabbi Yisrael Rosenberg. He was Rebbe in many communities, particularly later in life. He basically remained in the New Jersey area. He was in Patterson, he was in Bayonne, he was in Jersey City. He had various rabbinates. From one point he was in Washington for a short while. He was in Burlington, Vermont. The man had various rabbinates, but his strength was as a leader, as a pacifier, as a peacemaker in the Agudas HaRabbanim. And Rabbi Yisrael Rosenberg, in the biography by Rav Shurin, he credits Rabbi Yisrael Rosenberg with bringing about the reality of the Shas. According to Rabbi Shurin, there was so much machlokes and vested interest and money and the Travis family and Yeshiva Shibitzkol Hanan and the Agudas HaRabbanim, and these people are going to go and publish Shas, and the one who brought it all about was Rabbi Yisrael Rosenberg. And Rav Shurin calls him the diplomat, that he had that ability. They could yell, they could shout. These great minds got together, and each one had his own point of view, but it was Rabbi Yisrael Rosenberg who could calm them down, and he was the one she'alat Agudas HaRabbanim le'oto madrega rama uletafkida hakoveya b'chayei ha'yehudim b'America b'olam. And he was the one that lifted it, raised it, enabled it to lead, found peace, found a common concept between the various rabbanim, and he put it on the map. At the end of this article, and it centers around the printing of Shas, and by the way, he uses the word tzilum, photocopy, that's how they did it. He gives you a little bit of his background, and it's interesting, his smicha is from the Aruch HaShulchan. So you see, that also tells you something. Of all the achronim you'll come across, the one that was most down to earth and was really in the world 99 to 100% was the Aruch HaShulchan. He was the posek, he understood, he knew languages, he knew the generation, and this was his Talmud, and I recall the memory fondly. My own interaction over the years was a funny interaction with his son, with his family. What happened was that in doing my work on Rabbi Revel, I got to interview there was a Talmud Mufak of Rabbi Revel, Rabbi Ziv, Rabbi Usher Ziv. You recognize the name. He has two sons. One I know lives in Teaneck. He wrote on the Raman, a very important work. It was just republished. I understand they expanded it and even added to it. Very important work.
Hebrew.
Yeah. He was a fine Talmud Chacham. He was a Yerushalmi. From what I gather, he studied in Merkaz Harav. And I knew him, and he held a big shtetl in the Bronx. He was a very chashuv rav, taught at yeshiva. And Rabbi Asher Ziv, I lost my chain of thought. We were talking about Rabbi Rosenberg. We were talking about...
The
Aruch HaShulchan. Rabbi Asher Ziv, his work on the Ramah was outstanding. He brought the Ramah, showed the Ramah, caught up these Shailut and Shuvar, how they were caught up in the difficulties of life. It didn't come Yesh Meyayin. I don't have to tell you the famous story of the Ramah being Masada Kedushin in the middle of the night, and Friday night, and all that went on with it. And when you look at the Aruch HaShulchan, you see that the Aruch HaShulchan had that same ability, caught in the thicket of life. You go through the Aruch HaShulchan, you'll see he uses Polish words, Russian words. He explains what it means. He explains Kavanah. He explains how it affects the Halacha. And this was Rabbi Rosenberg. Rabbi Rosenberg was totally with it. He understood. Now I'll tell you. So when I did my work on Revel, I interviewed Rabbi Asher Zev. So Rabbi Asher Zev tells me, in those days when you went in for the Smicha Bechina, you went in two people together. For instance, I daven at generally during the week, I daven in Kamara, but Yatama, there's a guy there davening Natan Lobel. Natan Lobel, Nosson Lobel, went in for the Smicha Bechina with Dovi Hartman. So whenever I see them, I think of them together. And I can always tell you, two fellas before our time, the Bechinas were oral. Rabbi Asher Ziv went in with the Muscova Ilui. Anyone remember who that was? Rav Meir Karlin. He later taught at BTA. He was called the Muscova Ilui. And he arrived at Yeshiva in the late 30s. And he and Asher Ziv went in together. So Rabbi Ziv told me, he said, I'll tell you an interesting thing that happened. We began the Bechina. Who was supposed to give the Bechina? Rabbi Moshe Soloveitchik, Rabbi Revel, and a representative or two of the Agudas HaRabbanim. And we'll come to this later in our Shiram, not today, but down the line. Who was the representative of the Agudas HaRabbanim? Rabbi Israel Rosenberg. And he was late. So Rabbi Shaziv says, we got involved in the Bechina. Rabbi Moshe and Rabbi Revel got involved in a whole argument over the pshat, and Rabbi Israel Rosenberg walked in, and he saw it. We began the Bechina without him. No one's paying attention to him. Everyone's involved in a deep discussion. He turned around and walked out. And I wrote that in what he called it, in Revel. I don't know if I should have written it, but I was a kid. I wrote it around. I wrote it in a nice way. It was factual. And I was describing what went on in this whole relationship between Ritz and the Agudas HaRabbanim. So Rabbi Rosenberg's son, I think it was his only son, I think he had one son and three daughters. This son, if I'm not mistaken, was a prominent lawyer. And he contacted me, I have it in my files, he wrote to me that my father was never late, this could never have been. The whole story is incorrect. So I checked again with Rabbi Asher Ziv, and he said, I'll swear to you in a pile of Bibles, this is exactly what happened. And his own children said it was legendary in the family. So that's Rabbi Asher Ziv, that's Rabbi Rosenberg. But the Halacha L'maisa, I can also tell you, in 59 years of teaching Torah, I've never been late. True. But there were times I was late. For instance, the dean of the school I was teaching in held me up. There was a problem. Whitey Horowitz had to speak to me. Gabby Cohn had to speak to me. Whatever happened, Reb David Miller had us. We were in the middle of something. So I couldn't come to class exactly on the moment. I was 4 or 5 minutes late. Okay. It doesn't mean we're only humans. It can happen. But it's a fascinating story, where I got the letter and I checked again, and Baruch Hashem, Rabbi Asher Ziv stood his ground. But halacha l'maisa, we have to recall the memory of Rabbi Israel Rosenberg. And the Rav had tremendous derech eretz from him. How do I know? So here I had the shik mazel, meaning good mazel at a bad time. That's how I want to interpret it. After the Yom Kippur War, we didn't know whether alive or dead. Those of you who were here know what I'm talking about. And I was doing research at the time on Silva. And I found out that the Silva archives, not the Silva archives, that the Rosenberg archives Arat the Hebrew U at the Institute for Contemporary Judaism, organized by Moshe Davis. Remember, these are names out of the past. An American graduate of the seminary, a conservative rabbi, but a Shemesh Shabbos, it was a different generation. And he organized the Institute of Contemporary Judaism. I don't know, it still might exist at Hebrew U until today. He did the book, The Emergence of Conservative Judaism. That's Moshe Davis. It's a very important volume. And he had the Xerox of all the seminary files at the Hebrew U. Where did the Rosenberg papers wind up? At JTS. The Xerox of them was at Hebrew University. Now it's after the Yom Kippur War. I want to get in. The person in charge is a YU graduate, Yeshiva College 48, Moshe Goodman, Zichrono Levracha. He is the executive director for this department working under Davis. He is an officer in the army, a liaison between America and Egypt, between Israel and Egypt, down south. If you recall what happened after the Yom Kippur War, for months the troops were facing each other. He is a liaison because he speaks perfect English. He's an American, and their man knows English as well. And I go to him. He's busy in the army. He's the last thing in his mind. He says, take the keys and go in and look at it. And I had the keys. I went in. I Xeroxed whatever I wanted. No one bothered me. I got treasures out of there. But what you saw from the correspondence of Rabbi Rosenberg, the Rav had unbelievable derech eretz for him. And one of the, I think I later published it, is the Rav writing about the death of his father, and he's writing to Rabbi Yisrael Rosenberg, how can I observe the Seder? How can I have Pesach? How can I be happy if I'm still in very deep mourning over my father? And he's writing to him, I know what I'm doing is wrong writing this. It's 30 days before Pesach, but I can't help it. You're not allowed lorer at Hatzah 30 days before. He says, I must let my head down and confide in you. So you see that the Rav had tremendous derech eretz for Rabbi Yisrael Rosenberg. Okay, so that closes out the little chapter on the Shas. Today it's lost and forgotten, but it's a piquante moment in the history of Torah, the Agudas Rabbanim, Yeshivas of Shulchanan, at the telegraph to Rabbi Revel, what was it all about? And when he writes in his own handwriting, Shas, that was the fall on the Shas. But let us go one step further.
Isn't there still a reform movement put out a historical magazine once, a journal once in a while?
What are you referring to?
I don't remember the name.
But what about it? What about it? The archives?
Yes.
Archives of the reform.
Something like that.
Right.
It should be in there.
Well, someone has to do the research. I don't think there are any more papers available. See, I don't know. I saw all that Rabbi Revel had. Whether the Agudat HaRabbanim has anything, I have tremendous doubts. I think it's all lost.
You know, they say that the enemy of good is best. You don't have to have every document.
All right,
Satan.
So I
Halavai,
someone should throw it out. And Halavai, remember, if anyone's listening to me, Rabbi Belkin's more important than the Shas. Got it? Baruch HaTodan HaMelech Olam Shekhoni Yavidvarov.
You mean writing about Rabbi Belkin?
Exactly.
Well,
no, it's understood. That's what I mean. Writing about Rabbi Shmuel Belkin. Okay, now we go one step further. From money to money, but this is the real topic over which doctorates have been done. More will be done. Gentlemen, the greatest problem we had in the United States is the kashrut problem. The kashrut problem lends itself, if you see in the state of Israel, the problems we have today, and remember, Israel is more or less a controlled, conservative society, conservative with a small c, and yet take a look at Sohar, the rabbinate, kashrut. Just last night with the Balabas, he was telling me what he saw in Tel Aviv. So America lends itself, it's wide open to any scandal under the sun. Ish hayashav beinav ya'aseh. America, freedom, self-expression, no monopolies. The Kashrut problems are overwhelming. Here we have to pay homage to the OU. There's no question what the OU did for Kashrut. There's no price you can put on it. The tens of millions of dollars that the OU makes from their supervision all over the world, all of you know that it does not go into any private pockets. It not only supports the OU, but it supports NCSY. It supports Yachad. You can't put a price on what the OU has achieved. Some of the best students I've taught over the millennium, I'll put it that way, are products of NCSY. And the OU estimates to make a kid from, they have to invest about $50,000. You know what that means in the programming and everything they're doing. It works out. One kid became from, out of so many, it's a $50,000 investment. You got to give them all the credit in the world. What they do, biyachad, children who are challenged, lo aleinu, they have homes. I've seen with my own eyes some of the work they do. So I stand in awe of the OU. But it took way more than 100 years of Torah settlement in America to give us the OU. And Kashrut was wide open. People could achieve success. People could get involved. No one could stop you. No one can ask for credentials. In America, you can do whatever you want as long as you don't break someone else's windows. And even if you break someone else's windows, at times the penalty is so light that it's worth breaking the windows just to go ahead and do whatever you want. All right. Now, kashrut is a necessity. We all need kosher food. You come to a community, your first need is kosher food. The second need is a mikvah. The third need is a shul. A shul, in America, you think the shul is the most important. The shul basically is the third important. But kashrut, without kashrut, you can't eat. All right, the story of America, as you know, is very sad. The first great attempt was Rabbi Jacob Joseph on the east side of New York. What a sad story. Nothing remains, not of the Joseph family. And that whole attempt to organize kashrut fell apart within a few years after it began. We spoke about it in great detail. Much has been written, much has been researched. If you recall, Jacob Schiff gave $100 and suddenly a satmar writing about the history of RJJ turned him into a Yiddish tzaddik. He was president of Temple Emmanuel, but he did have a Torah upbringing in his youth. Then, of course, you have the Chicago incident, the story of the Ritbaz, and he almost is killed in the freezing warehouse, if you recall. Also a very, very sad story. An entire doctorate was done. I'll quote him. He lives in Yerushalayim today. I taught with him for many years at Machon Gold. Maybe some of you know him. Harold Gatzworth, G-A-S-T-W-I-R-T, Fraud, Corruption, and Holiness. Fraud, Corruption, and Holiness. It's an entire doctorate just dealing with New York City, 1881 to 1940, and all the machlokot there were over kashrut. The doctorate was done at Columbia University. I believe it was the new School of Social Research. It's a very, very prominent doctorate, very, very fascinating doctorate. Okay, but I'm not interested in all the details. I'm rather interested in the success stories. And here there are two tremendous success stories that are in Yonah D'Yoma. We just finished Pesach. And one of the stories he talks about very briefly, beginning on page 6, it's a story where I know the people, among them my own students, Horowitz Margaretten. The Horowitz Margaretten story begins, a guy named Jacob Horowitz arrives in the United States January 1883. He arrives from Hungary, and he was a real from Jew, and the Hungarians were not pleased with the matzahs that were being baked on the east side of New York. It didn't meet their standards, and they called upon Jacob, who had had experience in the old country, go and do some baking for us. And that's how he began. Within a year or two, his daughter came to America, his four sons, his son-in-law, and the whole family got involved in the business. And for 5 years, all the Hungarians on the Lower East Side, who did they turn to for matzah? To the Horowitz family. They're related by marriage to the Margaretten family. These people were from, these people were Hasidish, these people were reliable. What's very interesting, for the first 5 years, they had no rabbinical supervision. Tell me, if I come into your house stove and your wife serves me coffee and cake, do I ask you for a certificate? Absolutely not. I'm somach on your kashrut. I know you. I know you. I'm a somach 100%. Exactly the same thing here. Who needed Heksha? They knew the Horowitz family. They knew the Margaretten family. They absolutely did not need any Heksha. When I came in Aliyah, on Rehov Mordechai Ben Hillel, in the center of town, was a little bakery. They absolutely had no Heksha. If you walked in, the newcomers, the Anglos, who didn't know them, we asked if they have a tudah. They looked at us. They were insulted. You're asking whether we have a tudah. And everyone bought for them. Checked it out. Erev, oh, you can eat off the floor. On Pesach. Totally, totally reliable. Tzadikim Yisodei Olam. And that's the way the Horowitz family began. Within 5 years, they expanded. They became a business. Once they became a business, then, of course, Heksha was essential. And the Horowitz Margaretten business is probably the first matzah business in America that goes beyond its own little area. They are, we can use the word exporting, beyond the Lower East Side. People are starting to buy. People have confidence in them. They have succeeded. They are number one. However, number one pales by comparison with another family. And of course, it's probably the most famous name in Kashrut, I would imagine, in the world. I don't think in Israel you have 1,000,001 companies world famous, but the Manashevitz name is synonymous with kosher. What's amazing today is, I don't know if you realize it, it's not even owned by Jews. It's on the stock market, the majority shares. It's someone who ran for president of the United States. Can you give me the name? He ran for president, or he ran for the nomination, and a Quaker, if I'm not mistaken, a very wealthy family. They own the majority of shares in the company today. And Manashevitz has become such a conglomeration that ultimately it bought up every other kosher producer in America, including Horowitz Margaretten. True, when you go to the supermarket today, you will see Haaretz Margaretin, but it's not real. That's Manischewitz. It's exactly the same matzahs that you get in the Manischewitz box, but they manufacture and sell under a few different names simply to create a feeling of competition, not of a monopoly. The only other baker in America who really bakes is Stripes. Outside of that, what you have in the United States, and I saw it with my own eyes, are all the Israeli imports. And some places you can get the English matzah, Rasmuskin, I think it's called. It also has a different type of taste. So they're also available. But as far as matzahs being baked in America, matzahs being provided to the United States military forces, Manischewitz is Manischewitz. No one equals them. They built an ultra-modern plant in Newark today, and I believe it's the largest matzah plant in the world. I don't think there's any single plant in Israel that is as large and as modern, as sophisticated as the Manischewitz plant, the Newark new plant. Originally, they were in, I believe it was in Jersey City, and they invested downtown Newark. They wanted to gentrify. They were able to get a good deal on the land, and they invested a fortune of money there, and that is Manischewitz. Now, the story of Manischewitz is basically an American story with all the pros on the kashrut level, and here you have a family with tremendous common sense when it comes to Rabbanim and how to get Heksha and how to create goodwill. The founder of Manischewitz, 1888, an immigrant, Rabbi Dov Ber Manischewitz, many people just know him as Ber, Ber Manischewitz. I remember seeing on the boxes decades ago, Ber Manischewitz. But the full name is Rabbi Dov Ber. He came to America, opened a factory in Cincinnati, Ohio. And over the years, I'll give you names that I grew up with. Rokeach, how do they pronounce it in English? Rokeach. In Hebrew, it's Rokeach. You know what family that is. It's the Belzer Rebbe. Rokach. In Hebrew, it's Brokach. In Yiddish, it's in English, it's Rokich, Rokish, and in Yiddish, Sachman Rokeach. Three different names for the same family. The original Rokeach was the Belzer Rebbe's cousin. It was a Europäische Heksha. The Heksha was given by Rebbe Yitzchak Elchanan Spector, and they wound up in America. They were brought up by Manischewitz. Tam Tams. You all grew up in Tam Tams. I have to admit, the Israeli product, in my humble opinion, tops anything in America, but that's a different story. Tam Tams, brought up by Manischewitz. Seasons, do you remember Seasons from Newark, New Jersey?
Epstein.
The Epstein family. I'm still friendly with members of the family. They were brought up by Manischewitz. Mothers, Goodman, Matzahs, Mothers, Fish, Mrs. Adler's Fish. And you can go on, and ultimately, Haaretz Margaretin, everyone brought up by Manischewitz. Now, the story, here we want to call him on another professor, a name you all know, Professor Sana, Jonathan D. Sana, who teaches...
Brandeis,
but he's also given lectures at Yeshiva, at Rutgers, at Touro College. He's a very edely yid. I've met him and very impressed by him. Very edely. His father taught, if I'm not mistaken, at the seminary. His father was a professor of Bible, if my memory is correct. Excuse me?
Nachum Sana.
Nachum Sana. So he did research how matzah became square, Manischewitz and the development of machine-made matzah in the United States. Okay, now I want to spend a little, it's a very, very fascinating story. A little bit I knew even before the research, but I have to say his research put it all into perspective. I also want to add a personal note that I have a very deep feeling for the Manischewitz family. And I think I told you the story, but I can repeat it in context. A good deal of my life goes back to the Manischewitz family, and the story is very simple. In some point in the 60s, mid-60s, early 60s, I had a student, Hirsch Manischewitz. Hirsch is the son of Bear. This is a grandson of Hirsch, named after his grandfather. And under Hirsch is where the family, where the building, where it really expanded. And I had this student, and I had some influence on him, Baruch Hashem. Well, one day I'm minding my business on a Monday morning, today's Monday, and in the middle of shiur I get a note, Rabbi Belkin wants to see me. All right, Rabbi Belkin wants to see you. I closed my Gemara, I told the boys, let me see what's happening, I'll be back as soon as possible, continue to learn B'chavrata. Room 212, second floor, main academic center, Yeshiva University. And I go downstairs, a minute later, in Dr. Belkin's office, Mrs. Atlas, his girl Friday, his secretary, Helen Atlas, ushers me in, and Rabbi Belkin says to me, Kumar Chagresi Yashikayach. I owe you a big yashikayach. So I don't know what's going on. Rabbi, you owe me. Well, what's happened? And Rabbi Belkin says, Zetzacharek, Echvalach, Tetzel, and sit down, I'll tell you the story. And those were the days, we spoke before an hour ago about Meshulachim, right? It's hard for Charlie to conceive of why you, Meshulachim. You understand? But this is already a better stage. Parlor meetings, okay? So Sunday morning there was a parlor meeting on the Upper West Side. Rabbi Belkin was the speaker. And Rabbi Belkin tells me that all these important people that gathered, I just spoke on the West Side, one of my 10 talks was on the Jewish Center. I began my talk by saying, it's you people have to celebrate. 90 years ago, Yeshiva College began in this very building, September 1928. No one realizes that. The uptown campus was not yet ready. So Yeshiva College, I said you should put a plaque on the building. The shul is 100 years old. And 90 years ago, Yeshiva College began on these premises. So Rabbi Belkin says all these important people are assembled. And I'm about to begin speaking. And just then the most famous personality in the community walks in. The widow of Reb Tzvi Hirsch Manischewitz. And this lady, born in Cincinnati, perfect English, she says to Rabbi Belkin, loud and clear, oh, Rabbi Belkin, I'm very happy to see you. I want you to know that every morning when I wake up, I thank God twice. Once for returning my soul, and once for giving me Rabbi Rothkopf. And Dr. Belkin says to her, I can understand it. I understand returning your soul, but what do you mean giving you Rabbi Rothkopf? And she says, I have my grandson, the apple of my eye, named after my late husband, and Rabbi Rothkopf is his Rebbe in the yeshiva and has turned him into a Ben Torah. And Rabbi Belkin says to me, you should know I got up and I began Moraita Rabotai, ladies and gentlemen, I don't have to make any appeal for you this morning. You have just heard the words of Mrs. Manischewitz. These words speak for themselves. I need your help that we can produce many Rabbi Rothkopfs, not just one. And your help to the yeshiva will enable us to achieve this noble vision so more and more parents will be able to say, I thank the Ribbono Shel Olam for giving me back my soul and my teacher's Rebbe. So I have to admit, I have a very fond feeling for the Manischewitz family. And this was one of my three moments, with Rabbi Belkin, where he thanked me immeasurably, and it influences my life. I'm sitting here going back to these moments in time. Okay. Now, what's interesting about the Manischewitz family, it's... tell me, what's the most famous Jewish tea that everyone uses? Who is Mr. Vasovsky? Was a Talmud of Reb Yisrael Salanta. And Mr. Vasovsky, the original founder, we're talking about a Musanik, a Yid, a Tzaddik. Vasovsky's tea, already in Russia, they had a shul, a cloise, where they davened every day in the business. That continues in Tel Aviv. If you go to visit the most sophisticated tea factory in the Middle East, you will see that there's a shul until today. He was a Talmud of Rabbi Yisrael Salanta. Mr. Dov Ber Manischewitz was already a Talmud of Rabbi Yisrael Salanta. He grew up in Memel. Memel was on the border between Germany and Poland. A lot of Russian Jews lived in Memel. The Manischewitzes were a Russian family that moved to Memel. They were involved in business. And in Memel, Rabbi Yisrael Salanta lived there for around 30 years, 1860 unto 20 years, I should say. 1860 to 1879. And in Memel, Dov Ber Manischewitz became a Musanik, a follower of Rabbi Yisrael Salanta, a very edel Jew. He became a Shaychet, and he was so edel that Rabbi Yisrael Salanta made him his personal Shaychet. Now, within a year or two, in the 1880s, Rabbi Yisrael already was dead. He died in 1882. He died actually, he had gone from Memel, he went to France. From France he came back to Russia, and he died shortly thereafter. In the 1880s, the family emigrated to the United States. His wife, whose original name was Nesha Reza, in America she was known as Natalie. And how did he come to Cincinnati? What was the story? And this was the usual American story. It repeats itself 1,000 times under. Over. Landslide. No one trusted you more than the Jews who knew you from the old country. The greatest problem in America was, it's like Israel, we are a conglomeration of immigrants. Go and prove who's who, who's what. But if you knew someone from the outer Chaim, from the old country, you could have confidence. It is said that a group of Cincinnati Jews who came from Memel, who came from Russia, who knew the Manischewitz family, they pleaded with them, "We need you here in Cincinnati." And he became a Sheikhed and Bodeg in Cincinnati. Fine. Within a few years, he was struggling to make a living. He was a shaykhid, he was a part-time peddler, and the Jews turned to him. 1888, this is the date that they give for the start of Manischewitz. I believe you see it, at least I remember in my youth, you saw it in every Manischewitz wrapper. In 1888, he opens a matzah factory in Cincinnati. And here, the matzah factory begins, it's not just local, the whole Midwest. Everyone is turning to Manischewitz. His frumkeit is beyond question. A Yid Tzadik, a Sheikhet, a Bodeg, a Talmud of Rabbi Yisrael Salanta. And he gets caught up. Here it is, America. Machine-made matzat. and we'll devote the first part of next week's shiur to dealing with this machlokes, how it affects manashevitz, how it affects their business, and how it puts them on the map. But more than that, this is a family with good business sense. And how they use their charity to enhance the name Manashevitz. It didn't become the golden name without a lot of common sense, a lot of investment, a lot of seichel, as we will see next week. And it's one of the most fascinating chapters on the American Torah scene. Ultimately, the Agudas HaRabbanim until today, they're the Rabbanim HaMachshirim. When I say until today, I should say until the 1970s, the 1980s. Today, of course, it's not just the Agudas HaRabbanim, it's under the OU, the most respected Hechsher in the world. But wow, what Manashevitz became, and their manufacturing, and their expansion, and their kashrut, and their matzat. Don't forget, square matzat. Whoever heard of square matzat? Think back, what did you have in Europe? What did you have at your Seder? Those of you makpid to use hand matzat, who would use a square matzah? Machine matzat, tremendous machloket. What was the machloket about? What was the fear about? Who were the balei machloket? What is the building we're sitting in? We're totally caught up in this machloket. Just think for 1 minute. Who put up the money for this campus? Who enabled Rakefet to make a contribution to Yeshiva University that may be worth, I don't know, $100 million? When I spoke at the High Point and I had the marching there and all the Rashi and the Rabbanim and the Rashi Yeshiva, Yossi, it was a very moving moment in my life. I don't want to mislead you. I was overwhelmed who came to hear me, who kissed me afterwards. But on my right I had the billionaires, the Board of Trustees. I should have been sitting with them. How much did you give Yeshiva? I gave this, got this campus. Wow, machloket. Yitz, I challenge you to put it together and see whether the Rebbe's telling the truth or making it up. This is not Hollywood. This is factual. But we'll leave it to next week. Yes, Morty?
Didn't the machlokes for machine matzah start in Europe?
Yeah. We'll see. Of course, it starts in Europe, but we'll see what happens in America. And
the question is, was it Hashem Shemayim or was it jealousy?
And Yitzchak, every machlokes may have a little bit of jealousy, but this begins with Hashem Shemayim. What gives you the right to change the way they made matzah for 4,000 years? Who are you? How did your great-great-grandparents in the desert make matzah? Don't tell me they had machines.
They sat in the dark too, they never just...
All right, the Seder.
Yeah. Part of the thing, in Europe, when you're starting machines, the machines were mechanical, human-powered. They went more to electric.
Yeah, well they went more to electric, and but America's America. We'll see. Yeah. We'll see what the fears are. And let me put it this way. Thank God we have matzah in America, period, okay? So to reiterate, the story of Torah in America, very fascinating. The Agudas Rabbanim, this is the golden era, and one of their golden achievements is Manashevitz. And you'll see the way Manashevitz works with the Rabbanim and works with Yerushalayim. There's business sense here. What I'm going to teach next week could be taught in a class on what do they call it, Sai Sims School for Business. Is that the name, Maya? Do I have it right?
Sims
School for Business. So, all right, they're good to serve Rabbanim. The Rav Kook was Rav Kook. There's no question he was the focal figure. His talk in 24 is very interesting when you look at it in retrospect 90 years, 100 years later. Have we solved these problems? Do these problems still exist? What is the approach? Who is right? You understand, today we spend millions and millions of dollars in outreach. Take a look at the return we get. When you hear you made a kid frum and now you say, well, it cost $50,000 to make him frum. Is it worth it? I always say, look at this one kid you made from. He marries. Look at him 3-4 generations from now. This kid, you have 50 descendants, 60 descendants. Just think, it multiplies.
Think for a moment, your mother and father sending you to a
base. Yeah, yeah, no.
Instead of sending you to college.
No, no.
My mother in 1943 sent me to my mother.
Right.
But her neighbors told her, this is Reuben. Your son will grow up not knowing English.
Right.
He'll live in the ghetto. He'll be culturally deprived.
The Rav cried, spoke about it. Shulamit Meisman writes about it. Ein Hachinami, unbelievable. But this was Rav Kook. Very fascinating, a focal figure. And I try to portray what it was like then. They go to Surapana, Mizrahi, Aguda. And then we get involved with Kashrut. But before Kashrut, we did the Eagle Shas. What an achievement, you know, with all the little aggravation involved. And Rabbi Rebel suffered, the Travis family, he was caught in between. He had access to the money. Everyone thought he was the key. And his in-laws, you know, are willing to invest money, but they want a good investment. These are business people. It's an amazing story. I hope to publish in the Rakafet Aron a letter that Mrs. Revel wrote. The letter is about me, about starting my research, but I'm not publishing the letter for self-aggrandizement. I'm publishing the letter, she should be remembered. That lady, I'm going to write that if not for her family, the whole concept of yeshiva would not be here.
Even though it has nothing to do with Torah development, Funken Wagner's published the Jewish Encyclopedia in 1922. That was an achievement.
Earlier, 1905. Earlier, yeah, you're way later. 1905, 1907, 1910, and it comes out, I think by 1912 it was totally finished. It came out volume by volume.
Right.
It was a great achievement. Yes. It was a great achievement.
Can you imagine the paper is still good?
Right. The paper is still good. I rebound my set, but the paper is still good.
Some of the articles are some of the best in the Jewish world.
Right. That made Louis Ginsberg famous. Okay. And I just want to mention, no one should forget, next Sunday we're back in the world of Mamzeret. I have a fascinating, you'll see Rav Ovadia. Then we'll get back to Tells, the Kaddish, to Rav Menashe Klein, but I want to finish the Mamzeret properly. Yitzchak, this is for you. I have a lot of freebies. This is very interesting. This is Emunat Itecha. It's articles on modern-day Israel, integrating technology, development, new developments. It's all the forward-looking institutions that exist under the aegis of the greater Mizrahi ideal. All their articles, it's amazing who contributes here. Tzomet, Machon Pua, Machon Torah, V'Haaretz. Very fascinating, all the modern articles. Those are two recent volumes. These are the latest Jewish action, if you didn't see it. And this is NCSY, the work they're doing, Ignite. Malka says, what does that word mean, ignite? I said, to ignite young Jews to their Judaism. And I stand in awe of what they're doing. Only Lubavitch can tap this, let's say. Here are a slew of articles. New York Times. This is with Pope Francis. What has he achieved? Pope Francis, on one hand, seems to be very liberal. On the other hand, he must be conservative. And it's, you'll see the pro and the con. This is interesting. The babushkas for Putin. All the older ladies love Putin. He gets 100% of their vote. This is an obituary for David Wyman, who published on the Holocaust. He's the first one who publicly called Roosevelt to order for not doing a damn thing to save Jews. Very interesting. I don't know him personally, but the man did great things. This is the Lubavitcher Rebbe Health and Psychiatry, Dr. Michael Greenbaum on the Rebbe. Anyone who loves documents, here's a letter by Einstein to a Hasidic Rebbe. Very fascinating. Chief Rabbinic, German. Chief Rabbinic, this is what we're living with, what Rakepet spoke about at Stern College. I'm waiting to hear a reaction. If anyone over the world is listening and has anything to say about the Rakepet plan to save humanity. Chief Navrit refuses women to take tests on female laws. This is about women who want to take the test on Dine Nida and get the, I guess, a form of smicha that they know it. The Chief Navrit refuses. This is United Kingdom Haredi world. They're censoring textbooks. The Board of Education in England is going after them. Big machloket. This is Chabad, a filmmaker who's from. Interesting story. These are Haredim in Yerushalayim who are receiving a degree at the Strauss campus, the Haredi Strauss campus, and people are yelling at them, Nazi and Sheikits, one of the problems we live with daily here. This is the New York Times. Is Leonard Cohen the new secular saint of Montreal? And you all know Leonard Cohen's grandfather was the most chashuv of Rav in Montreal, Canada, during the period we were speaking about this morning. This is about the Christians and the money they're giving to Rav Yechiel Eckstein. They are the biggest advocates of Aliyah today for the Jews. If you want to come in Aliyah from the Ukraine or any such area, they will pay all expenses. New Yorkers complain of matzah bakery smoke suffocation. It deals with hand bakeries in Williamsburg, and the smoke is troubling the people. Ashrei Ayin Rat Hazot, modeled on Yeshiva University, the first Jewish university to open in Russia. This is in Moscow. And since I was there 9 months ago, so much more has happened. More shuls are open. It's just amazing. Will New York Times, everyone is quoting Rakefet. I said it first. Cyrus, will the embassy move to Jerusalem? A biblical Trump. And absolutely. Rav Ovadia's daughter, the enlightened one in favor of education, Ovadia Yosef's daughter, quote, if it was up to me, Shas would disappear, end quote. Gentlemen, this is worth another 5% on your taxes to see what's going on in Shas, the entertainment, the infighting, the religious politicians. Ah, my dear friends, leave me alone. If I meet one religious person in my life, I'm going to be very happy. The Midnight Call, Mr. Naftali Feldman, and the Rebbe's advice to him. What we spoke about in class, this is from Aryeh Gordon. Those of you interested, the interconnection of Rabbi Zivitz, who made the shidduch between Rabbi Rebel and Mrs. Sarah Travis, and his own grandfather's involved, Rabbi Leida. This is very interesting and very sad, but very necessary. A woman told us, who we met in Leningrad in the 80s, Yitzhak Kogan's mother said, "Min lust nish lebenda, min lust nish tavenda." They don't let you live in Russia, and they don't let you die. There are no Jewish cemeteries. They just inaugurated a new Jewish cemetery in Moscow. This is my Talmud, Rabbi Moshe Wiener, trying to influence me to grow a beard. And as I said, I'm a member of the Mossad, but interesting to read. Again, the Rebbe giving advice to a Mrs. Gila Lillian. Vatican magazine expose. Nuns revealed their economic exploitation. An interesting topic. I grew up with nuns all over the place in the Bronx. I never thought about that. They work for the church for next to nothing. Wow. Trump stumps lawmakers would call for gun control. Interesting what's going on in America after Florida. The kids that are marching and yelling and shouting and screaming, and boy, are they right, and do we have to thank God for Israel, where every Tom, Dick, and Harry has a gun, including about four members of my own family have guns. And Baruch Hashem, no one shoots the other one. They use it properly. Orthodox Women's Group celebrates 40 years of their reading the Megillah, part of the ongoing quest that we have, feminism. The new plan that Trump has come up with, so a backer of Trump, Morton Klein, president of the COA, you all know him, says it's a bad mistake. New York Cardinal Pell confronts charges of historical sexual abuse in the church. And this is about the Yeshiva University basketball team that went so far, and they didn't. They one time they had to play after they were fasting, another time before Shabbat. They will not play on Shabbat, article after article, and at least there's a bit of a Kiddush Hashem. I want to thank everyone for coming from the bottom of my heart for enabling me to get back to the world that sustains me. And Be'ezrat Hashem, we will pick up again next Sunday and Monday, and it should only be L'Besor HaTova, the length of our Kol Yisrael. Yosef, will you still be here? When do you go back?
Next week I'll be here.
Good. Okay, so you don't have to call up Yomo and put back to work and give him a watch that he should know. If I can handle it, that is fine.
Is Nachum Sander's article about when Matzah got straight?